Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is
Neat.
It's a weekly booze cast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Hey, happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yay.
And happy Pride to all of you out there celebrating with us.
We're doing a Pride episode. Yeah. This is it. It's happening right now.
Just and if you're listening to this in like August, just because that's when you got around to it, that's okay too. Happy Pride still.
Happy Pride, Pride too. You can still be prideful.
Proud. Yeah. And gay. It's totally okay to be gay outside of the month of June.
Yeah, most people are.
Yeah. 365 days a year for some of us.
We're queer.
Oh,
that's it rhymed.
That rhymed. Oh, man. I miffed that one.
365 days of the year, we're queer.
That's what I should have said. Swing and a miss. All right. Let's get down to booziness. So for this episode, we're kind of talking about the same topic, just over two different like periods of time. Obviously, we talk about queer culture. It's hard to separate from bar culture.
True.
I'm gonna kind of give like some early queer bar culture in American history, and really it's world history at this time. We're going to be focusing on right. The scene that's happening in America.
Well, because all over the world, nightlife and bars have been really, like, the safe spaces for the queer community. You know, like, now, it's really cool now to see that there are sober spaces popping up that are safe spaces for queer folks. But generally, it's always been connected to nightlife and bars because that was really the only thing available.
Okay, so I want to talk about the origin of safe queer spaces, bar spaces in America. But we can't really do that without talking about another cultural event that was going on kind of at the same time period, and that is the Harlem Renaissance.
Ah.
So for those of you who don't know what the Harlem Renaissance is, a little bit of background to it. Basically, and this is super basically, post-Civil War, we had, you know, rights established for Black people in America, freedom of slaves. Things weren't great for Black people still. I know.
Yeah, that probably goes without saying.
Took a while. Still is taking a while. So even though they had certain rights established, there was still kind of institutionalized racism in the South that could not be penetrated. Like they were legally allowed to own property, but they weren't sold property.
Nobody would sell it to them.
Yeah. Like they were allowed to have any job, but
no one would hire them.
Yeah. And then yes, you could no longer be a slave, but suddenly it was okay to put people in prison to labor. And then, right. We're going to arrest all the Black people in the South.
Right, that's a thing. Like, the fine print of that was abolish slavery, except for in cases of imprisonment.
Right, which is why we have the horrible, the prison complex we have today, which is just modern slavery.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Fucked up shit.
Yeah.
Throughout history. Thanks, America.
Yeah. Like, that. So yeah, so not a great time to be a Black person in America. Definitely not great in the South. You have something called the Great Migration begins around like the late 1800s, where you have a lot of people of color moving to city centers. And I mean, you still have people immigrating to America too, and they're generally concentrating in larger cities, in places like New York and Chicago, and in those places, this sort of like mix of cultures allows for certain identities to kind of carve out spaces for themselves, to have neighborhoods that are theirs, to have like, you know, like the ability to keep their culture, have their identities, and have safe places to exist and flourish. And also like monetary opportunities, because this is moving into like World War One time period where there are all these industrial jobs that it's basically like somebody's got to do it. The racism right. didn't have, really have
they
play
weren't
here.
As discriminatory in who they were hiring.
Yeah. From this, the Harlem Renaissance. Now, when we use that phrase, what comes to mind is suddenly all of these people in Harlem started producing all of this amazing art and music and dance. And while, yes, that's what they were doing, they'd always been doing this.
Right.
Like, there's a...
It wasn't so sudden.
No. One of the important figures in this, there's a Hubert Harrison, who was the... who founded, like, the Liberty League and The Voice. Like, he was a writer. He was an activist during this time period, prominent member of the Harlem Renaissance. But he kind of, like, was a little bit ambivalent about that because he's like, look, we've always been doing this stuff. It's just, like, I don't know, a bunch of white people, like, came up and, like, discovered what we were doing. And
they
we're
discovered.
Like, I think Columbus are cool stuff.
Oh, like, shit.
That's a little bit what was going on. I mean, there was this concentration, and there was definitely more of, like,
flourish.
Like an energy that yeah. came behind it, but you know that it's not like this wasn't stuff that was already happening. But I mean, at this time period, like you have coming to the forefront of culture, like the rich elite in these cities were partaking in this culture. They were they were, you know, listening to jazz. They were listening to like they were watching black dancers. They were listening to black musicians. It was the cool thing of the moment. I mean, you had like Josephine Baker was like a fashion icon. She was a dancer.
Love
and
her.
Like yeah,
banana dance.
Or like Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington. Like this is their time period. This is when they came about, and this is, you know, going into like the 1920s. So this was already in synthesis. You already had all of these incredibly talented, like. Performers in Harlem. Now, during this time period, that was a place where queer people also had a certain amount of safety. It wasn't as much on the forefront, but it was sort of like, hey, we're protecting ourselves. You can be safe too here.
Okay.
We associate this time period with kind of the rise of the blues, but as much as the blues was like very much as much as the blues was is obviously an African American thing, it also was sort of a queer thing.
Really?
Yeah, like you have like blues wasn't as popular as jazz at the time. Blues clubs were a little bit like more off the beaten path, and a lot and like some of the early like the mother of blues, who was Ma Rainey, she had. Open lyrics about her bisexuality. She was arrested once for participating in an orgy with some of her background singers. Like,
fuck yes.
Yeah. So, like, you have, like, a culture where, like, yes, they want to be taken seriously as artists. They're not necessarily, like, putting queer people on the forefront, but they are allowing it to exist.
Okay.
Yeah, and you had, there's another, one of Rainey's protégés, Bessie Smith, who used blues as a way to also express her sexuality, and she, like, has these great lyrics like, when you see two women walking hand in hand, just look them over and try to understand. They'll go to those parties, have the lights down low. Only those parties where women can go.
Oh, Bessie.
Yeah.
No.
Like, and this, and you have, of course, the, this sort of evolves into like ball culture. Like, this is the birth of the Hamilton Lodge in Harlem, where you have your first drag balls happening. So you've got the Harlem Renaissance. You've got gay culture sort of flourishing, being a little bit more accepted, defining itself, and then you have a really, really important, finally we're talking about booze again, booze-related event.
Booze.
Prohibition.
Oh, not so much booze.
Well, actually... well,
but actually...
so that's the thing. So,
lots of booze.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, Prohibition stopped some people from drinking, but it didn't stop nearly as many people from drinking as it just made people drink in different places, different ways, with different people. And to that end, culturally, it was incredibly important and incredibly stimulating.
Cool.
Like, you had, everybody agreed on one thing during Prohibition, that's we want to drink.
Yeah.
So you have, like, you know, rich socialites going into these neighborhoods where it was a lot easier to go into a bar, to they were automatically already kind of illegal or not really on the radar, so they could go into these places. I mean, you had mob presence in gay bars back right. during this time period, and like, you know, there were mob runs, so they weren't going to run out of liquor. So you have all of these, that's like straight, white, like elite going into bars in Harlem, be they gay bars, be they like bars that were traditionally for black people, like, and sitting side by side and drinking with these people and engaging with their culture.
Hey, that's some radical queer history right there.
It was good for everybody involved. It became the trend. This particular time period, like once we like kind of get into prohibition, especially butting up against queer culture, it has a name. It's the pansy craze.
Oh.
I don't know how I feel about the name. I guess it's fine.
I don't know. Like, I don't what? Know. Wait. So was it like, how was that term used though?
It was not negative at all. This was what was cool. You had like these, you know, newspaper articles written in, like all the like the, like today what we would consider like, you know, the celebrity pages. They were all about like these 20, 30, 40 prominent American celebrities that would be at bars, at these drag shows, at gay bars. And that led to then these drag performers being like elevated to like performing on Broadway. Like it was this whole time period during Prohibition where all of this culture that had been sort of a subculture, had been its own culture, had it existed separately and very protected of its own, was infiltrated by mass culture, by pop right. culture, and was in turn embraced.
Right, because these kind of like made like cool by these socialites, right?
Yeah.
Like that are coming. I mean, that is like a little bit of, I'm sure there's a little bit of appropriation going on there, because it's like, oh, we discovered the next new thing. It's the pansy craze. Like, okay, well, you didn't, it was there before. People were always gay. But
yeah. And there is something, because when you talk about it, like, there are a lot of these people who are important figures during it where you can't help but fail to notice that they are generally cis male white men that mm-hmm. came in prominence as drag performers. That's not to say that these weren't legitimate people in the scene, but I do think it's interesting that when you scope through the handful of people whose names come up repeatedly, that those are the people that were given the Broadway shows.
Right. Like, and drag balls were happening in the Harlem Renaissance way before cis white men picked it up.
Well, I mean, even worse than that, like, a lot of times the drag balls, like the ones at the Hamilton Inn, like, or the Hamilton Lodge, they were kind of rigged, because they were, they like, everybody could, all races participated in them.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, white people won.
Really?
So that's kind of what led to people of color branching off and creating their own balls.
Right.
Like,
because they're like,
forward.
We started this shit, and yeah. then you came in here and ruined our fun, and now we gotta go somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is, you know, we were talking earlier about, like rainbow capitalism in their modern sense. Like, I want to be a little bit more, like, altruistic and say, like, hey, what happened here was, like, if things, and we'll get into this later, if history hadn't abruptly taken a sort of about face, maybe this would have developed into just the acceptance of queer culture as a whole.
Right.
But it still was definitely like queer culture was selling at this point.
Oh, yeah.
So we capitalized on it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's good, whether that's bad, obviously, like, in this time period, it didn't last. But there was a brief moment where people embraced it, whether it was because it was selling, whether it was because they loved it, whether it was because it gave them, you know, acceptance. All these things are probably true in certain percentages.
Right.
But it's sort of a weird window of time where the coolest thing to do for the most elite high-profile celebrities in New York on a Saturday night was to go to a drag show.
Right. Yeah.
There were, like, and, you know, this, like, one of the prominent figures you read about a lot in association with this is Gene Mallon. He started off as a drag performer, and then at some point, he just dropped his drag act, and his act was at that point then, and he was an out gay man, but his act was just being, like, a clever, funny cutting gay man.
That's a great act.
Right?
He would still a great act.
Walk around dressed in like the best suit, the most stylish suit you could buy, make fun of the audience.
Or you had like Madame Spivvy, who was like she was an out lesbian, she was a nightclub owner, and a very witty lyricist, like, and these were like, you know, that was her persona, that's what she presented, and people paid to see it. One of the people that I really enjoyed was Gladys Bentley. Mm. Gladys Bentley started in the Harlem Renaissance, so this was before, like, before Prohibition, before the pansy craze, but she just continued to kind of own, like, she owned her own club. She was a drag king.
Yes. Like,
yeah, and she made safe spaces. Really, she's one of those that survived throughout all of this and continued to create safe queer spaces for people even after Prohibition.
She's a queer hero. She's a queero.
Queero. And she sang the blues. She's another one of those blues singers. Like, all of, I love this, like, whole series of, like, female blues singers that sang the blues about being gay.
Oh.
In the 1920s. Like, it's great. But unfortunately, this all came to kind of a very abrupt end.
Oh, no.
Because once we get into, like, the early 1930s, we have both the repeal of Prohibition and we have the Great Depression.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So, like, you think, like, repeal of Prohibition, we can all celebrate. Like, now we can all drink again. But that's actually not at all what happened. You had liquor laws were redrafted with the legalization of alcohol again. And some of those laws included, like, the banning of selling liquor in unruly spaces. That was coded language for gay spaces.
Ah.
You have, like, these bans on, like, or changes of codes for cinema and for plays where you could no longer show gay characters in sympathetic ways. Like, you know, you had Mae West up to this producing shows with, like, all gay casts and, like, telling gay stories. Like, now it's, like, this huge breakdown on, like, no, you can't show queer characters, you can't show them in any sort of sympathetic, like, light. So you really have what some historians have referred to as, like, the state-constructed closet.
When was that, that started, like, after, obviously, like, Prohibition ended, and then, like, that starts happening, like, is that just, like, a trend that just continues into the 50s, or, like...
You have the sort of reprieve as far as the Second World War goes, where... which I know we've talked about this, like, you can have, like you had people in service.
Right. So it was like, you know, you have, a lot of guys going off because they've been drafted, and then you see women taking those roles and even enlisting in service themselves. And so then it's not really, it's not really weird to see a woman in pants or right. like, and it's like there's kind of a little bit of safe space even within the military, because there's like same sex housing. Like, you're going to be in a space that you're not going to be integrated, or you don't have to necessarily, if you're wearing a uniform, you don't necessarily have to have a presentation of femininity or masculinity. So there's like a little bit of that during the war. And then when the war is over, America is like trying to come to this kind of idealized version of the American dream of like the nuclear family and very structured gender roles. And that goes like right into McCarthyism, which is real fucked up. I'm about to talk about it. So basically, one of the things that contributed to this, like the fuel to the fire that was McCarthyism that just like fucked up a lot of people's shit was the release of the Kinsey Reports. So the Kinsey Reports came out in 1948. Well, the first one came out in 1948, and that was sexual behavior in the human male. And then in 1953, it was sexual behavior in the human female. And these reports reinforce the then new notion that being gay was perfectly normal.
Oh, hey!
Hey, you know how there's always been gay people? They're not sick. They're fine. So, yeah, we're cool. And so
we are cool.
Yeah, we're basically to sum up the Kinsey reports, we're all cool, and also we're all a little gay.
Yeah,
if you're not really really gay, you're at least a little bit gay. Don't mean to burst your bubble.
So did this make people uncomfortable?
Yeah, there was like a really from conservative America, there was like a really big backlash of conformity and communist paranoia. So Joseph McCarthy really cashed in on that. You might have heard of the Red Scare, but have you heard of the Lavender Scare? Because that was his investigations, that was the part of his investigations that were anti-gay. And we're like looking into people in the government. Like, it wasn't just like, we're going to look into you and see if you're a communist. Like, we're going to look into you and see if you like to do some gay stuff. And we're going to get you for that.
I just really wish I'd Googled before this if there is a drag queen named Lavender Scare.
That's a really good name.
If there's not, there needs to be.
We'll give you that one for free, folks. Joseph McCarthy with this Lavender Scare really helped falsify this link between being gay and being a sexual deviant, an anti-American. Oh my God. Like,
well, as both a sexual deviant and an anti-American, I don't think it has anything to do with me being gay.
Right? Right? Well, I mean, it was really fucking damaging because it led to this extremely anti-gay legal system in the 1950s and the 1960s. And I promise I'm going to talk about bars again, but I really got to give you some of this background. This is some really crazy shit. So Illinois decriminalized sodomy in 1961, but in the 1960s, pretty much every other state criminalized homosexual acts, even if it's between consenting adults acting in private homes. You could face anywhere from a light fine to 5, 10, or 20 years, or even life in prison. And in 1971, 20 states had sex psychopath laws that determined so these sex psychopath laws.
That's our band name!
Sex psychopaths.
Sex psychopaths!
Oh my God. So these laws permitted the detaining of homosexuals just for that reason alone, just like for being gay. You could be committed to a psychiatric institution for life. And in 7 states, they could castrate you.
Damn.
Yeah. Throughout the 1950s and 1960s, being arrested for being a homosexual. That's a fun way of saying it.
Did you say homosexual? For being a homosexual.
There was all kind of fucked up shit they were doing. I mean, one of the ways that they were able to determine or like decide that you were gay and were gonna arrest you is by the way you dressed. This kind of dusted off an old anti-labor regulation law, and this was called the 3-item rule. Which allowed police to arrest individuals wearing fewer than 3 articles of clothing appropriate to their sex.
What are 3 articles of gendered clothing?
First of all, I mean, that kind of means you gotta wear a lot of clothes to begin with. You have to wear 4 things. You have to wear at least 4 things that are specifically gendered items of clothing that are quote-unquote appropriate to your gender. The thing is, these rules specifically targeted trans women and butch lesbians, basically. Because I'm sure if you were a very cishet presenting person, then like, if you were a woman who wore pants, then like, the police weren't going to be like, we think you're gay. Like, we're going to arrest you.
Hmm.
But if they already suspected that you were gay and you were wearing less than 3 items of clothing that was specific to your gender, then they could arrest you based on that, based on basically speculation.
So could I just, like, wear my normal clothes but, like, 3 bras underneath of it?
Ooh.
Can I check the system?
If you're willing to take that risk.
So female. I got three bras on.
These kind of anti-gay, just like blatantly anti-gay legislation and policing of people's bodies that continues. But that is kind of the sentiment and where we are in America that's going to lead up to dun-dun-dun-dun, Stonewall. But there were a few events that really helped set the stage for that. So one of them is the Compton Cafeteria Riot, which is really important to mention because, like Stonewall, it's another demonstration that was headed up by trans women of color. So conversely, there was also a sip-in in 1966 at Julius's in New York, held by the Mattachine Society. And that was actually to bring attention to laws banning restaurants from serving gay patrons. So they held a protest there, too. And this was more... So the Mattachine Society was, to be honest, it was a group of white men who were gay. Yeah. But so they were, as opposed to like these more riotous demonstrations that you see in California before... they were trying to kind of work with the system. They were really about like going through legislation and affecting change through laws, which is all well and good and is what we do want to do. We want to get those laws changed. But really, the goal of that was more to assimilate. And that sentiment really, although pretty well-intentioned, kind of leaves out the most vulnerable members of the LGBTQ community. Going back to what you were saying earlier about like this shutting down of establishments that were deemed disorderly, by disorderly, I mean gay. Up until this point, there's still very few establishments, even in New York, where queer people could gather, and none of them were owned by queer folks, but there is still like a very big need for this kind of space. So enter organized crime and the mob specifically. That's who owns Stonewall. And they're really just here to exploit LGBTQ patrons, and they're paying off the police. They're willing to do that. So Tony Loria, Fat Tony is what they called him. So he's in the mob, he's in the mafia. And so he paid the police around $1,200 a month to let him keep Stonewall open, which, just to give you a little math, that's $9,500 a month in 2019 dollars.
Oh.
In case you wanted to know. Well, and it wasn't a really nice establishment either. It was right. Basically like, it was stables that had a lot of fire damage that they painted black to kind of cover that up. They didn't have a running sink, so they kind of like threw glasses in a big basin, and then when they needed more, they like rinsed them out and dried them off. And there was also allegedly there was a prostitution ring upstairs. There was a lot of shit going on, a lot of shady shit going on, but we do have a little bit of space. Granted, all that being said, it was still a very popular place. And even like Wall Street dudes that were like on the down low knew about Stonewall as like the best gay bar in town and the best place for dancing. So Fat Tony paid off the cops to keep Stonewall open, but it was still raided frequently, probably like around once a month. So police raids were common, generally low-key and anticipated. They knew that they would come like clockwork. But at this time, around in 1969, there was a police raid a few weeks prior to June 28th, but there was pressure on, I guess, you know, he felt pressured, whatever, the police chief, Seymour Pine, to win some political favor with his crime-busting candidates. And so they didn't tell Stonewall on June 28th that they were going to come. I want to say too that, like, beyond being arrested for being suspected of a homosexual, which based on your the way that you dress, they also had undercover cops going in and infiltrating and basically, like, trying to bait people into exposing themselves for being gay. Like, they would flirt to you, they would flirt with you until you were like, hey, do you want to go home? And they were like, gotcha, you're under arrest. So during this raid of Stonewall, June 28th, 1969, it didn't really go as planned because they arrested some people, and then the vehicle that they needed to transport them wasn't there. It wasn't ready. So one of the people that they arrested was Stormé de la Verrie. They basically, like, walked her out, and then, like, the vehicle wasn't there. They walked her back in. They went back several back and forth several times. She broke out of handcuffs. They kept arresting her, and still this vehicle wasn't there. So after a while, she was like, she turned to the crowd and she was like, "Why don't you guys do something?" And at that point, an officer picked her up and threw her into the back of the wagon. And then the crowd went crazy and became explosively violent. So they were sparked by Stormé, basically Stormé's call to action. So Stormé de la Verrie was one of the butch lesbians that was there. The Stonewall Rebellion we can attribute to butch lesbians and trans women of color. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Two more of those figures were Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, who were, I mean, they were definitely in the scene. It's kind of, like, not clear in history exactly what their role was on that night, but they were definitely there. And they definitely, what really matters is that they were trans women and they became key figures in the gay liberation movement. So whether or not they threw the first brick or they were just there, because the riots lasted 6 days and they were there. Marsha P. Johnson, Marsha Pay No Mind Johnson, was known for climbing to the top of a lamppost and dropping a heavy bag on the police car's windshield, and she would shatter the windshields that way. And then Sylvia Rivera, the story, a little anecdote from Stonewall that she's known for is that, as she tells it, the bartender handed her a Molotov cocktail and said, "I'm going to light this on fire and then you throw it." And she said, "Well, if you're going to light it on fire, then I'm definitely going to throw it because I don't want it anywhere near me." So what really came out of this, so the riots lasted about 6 days. Really, the Stonewall Rebellion was the catalyst for the gay liberation movement. And a lot of stuff comes out of that. There wasn't really a lot of unified activist groups before then. And now we have, out of the Compton's Cafeteria riots, the Vanguard started. Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson co-founded the Street Transvestites Action League, STAR, in 1970. And here's the thing, like, even though they are icons and heroes in the community, if you really read into Stonewall, you find out more about them, they kind of go unnoticed in the mainstream retelling of the LGBT movement, and you can really see this in gay history. You can actually see footage of this if you watch the documentary on the life and death of Marsha P. Johnson. There was a gay liberation rally in 1973 that Sylvia Rivera was supposed to speak on. And they kept pushing her time back because, and it was largely due to the fact that during this time, even in the 70s, trans people and non-binary people and drag queens were seen as the stereotype. And for people who could, quote unquote, pass, or for, like, cis white middle class gays, they didn't want to really be associated because it meant that they would have to to give up the privilege that they had, or they would have to, they really wouldn't have to give it up. They would just have to use it in a different way.
Right.
When Sylvia finally got on stage, she called out the mostly cis white middle class crowd for being complacent and for not advocating for the victims of violence and arrest within our community, and really not advocating for victims of violence within our community when they're trans folks. She said she received letters from LGBTQ folks in jail who were writing her organization's star because they knew that they were the only ones who would listen. So she really called them out on that, and they booed her off the stage.
What?
Which is fucking incredible and fucking tragic and just like, I mean, these are our elders, and they, I say that like, you know, there are elders within the trans community, but like trans women of color are our elders in the gay community because they started the gay movement. We owe the gay liberation movement to trans women of color and gender nonconforming individuals.
That's even the brief bit of history that I talked about that was birthed from people of color, and largely people of color, but trans people. Like, it's, you know, they've always been on the forefront of our rights.
Yeah, absolutely. So this year actually marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion. And I'd say the best way to, and not just me, other people would say this too, the best way to celebrate Pride and commemorate our queer heroes is to...
Our queeros!
Is to support the members of our community who are the most vulnerable. So I actually have a list of organizations that are, if you're looking for somewhere to donate, if you're looking for somewhere to put your money towards, and also if you, you know, if you don't have the funds to do that, you can always share and share information. Let people know, let people that you know who have the funds to support these groups, let them know where they can direct their money. So some of these organizations are Trans Women of Color Collective, New York Anti-Violence Project, The Trevor Project, Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund, Trans Lifeline, which is like a hotline for trans youth, Transgender Law Center, Sylvia Rivera Law Project, GLSEN, Trans Student Educational Resource. There are tons and tons of organizations that are doing really good work, and we'll put all of these links on our show notes. But also, if you can donate directly to someone in need, that's really the best way to help that individual. The most effective way to support trans and non-binary individuals who are the most marginalized members of our community is to provide them with financial support. So, queer bars, man, queer nightlife.
I mean, you know, I'm glad that there are like sober spaces. I'm glad that we're creating queer spaces that are not centered around bar life. But that being said, like, I think it's still the language we use. I mean, that's a question that I feel like I still get asked. It's like, if someone's trying to get a hint on if you're queer or not, they go, what kind of bars do you go to?
Oh.
And if you're a straight person, you just go like, I don't know, like a bar that has good draft beers. And if you're a queer person, you know what that question means. And you go, oh, well, I'll tell you.
I like.
Yeah. Like it's a way of checking in with somebody. A lot of revolutionary thought was first made in bars. It is no different in the advancement of you know, queer identity and queer rights.
Yeah, well said.
Hey. So go to a bar or a sober space, whatever you prefer, but think something revolutionary and start a riot, because that's where the world's at these days.
Mm-hmm. And also, stay safe this Pride. Look out for each other, take care of each other, and be vigilant, really, because as we know too well, just because it's Pride Month doesn't mean that violence doesn't still happen. I think it's important to mention that there have been 5 Black trans women who have been killed or found dead just in the month of June. So really, really, now more than ever, always, it's really important to stay vigilant and take care of each other.
All right. Well, I have been this whole time Taylor Smurl.
Don't ever change. I'm Liz June. And this has been neat. Look out for our video companion where we're going to make some queer hero-inspired cocktails.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here we go.
All right.